SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandamingaya. I am Bertrand Tungandame and very happy to be with you this Wednesday, the 19th of June. Coming up in your program today, with tax season fast approaching, experts are urging caution due to a high number of scammers using the opportunity to target Australians for their personal and financial information. We also have a yarn with Beronga Wiradjuri, founder and principal artist of the Beronga Gallery in Meanjin, Brisbane, sharing insights into an upcoming tourism initiative that's set to offer a unique experience steeped in Indigenous history and culture. And after 13 years of dedicated campaigning, the Awabakal community in the Hunter region of New South Wales is celebrating the protection of its sacred butterfly cave. But first, the latest news on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Bulletin, JIRA explains to parliamentary inquiry how Indigenous women are made invisible in family violence data. Opposition leader Peter Dutton revealed sites of proposed nuclear reactors. And Victoria set to raise the minimum age of criminal responsibility to 12. An organisation providing culturally safe legal support and prevention for First Nations survivors of family violence says real-time tracking using accurate data would help direct resources to better tackle the issue of missing and murdered First Nations women and children. Aboriginal Community Control Organisation JIRA in Victoria told a parliamentary inquiry that too many First Nations women who are victims of domestic violence are misidentified by police as the perpetrators. Antoinette Gentili, JIRA acting CEO, says there is a need for more accurate data collection to support Indigenous self-determination.
At least 24% of the women we supported in 2023 had been misidentified as perpetrators of violence by police. Misidentification leads to criminalisation and is a major contributor to the removal of our children. JIRA has supported women who have reported violence to police only to be issued with a warrant for their arrest, often over poverty-related offending such as unpaid fines.
A new book outlines new details of mass killings of Aboriginal people by European settlers from 1824 until the 1980s in what became known as the Frontier Wars. For more than 20 years, as part of a truth-telling project, a team at the University of Newcastle, led by the late Professor Lyndall Ryan, has been mapping the prevalence and scale of the killings into what has become known as the Frontier Massacres. The project documented at least 10,000 First Nations deaths across 400 instances of killings between 1794 and 1928. Over the same period, 152 settlers were killed by Indigenous people in 12 incidents. Dr. Robin Smith at Charles Darwin University says her new book, License to Kill, Massacre Men of Australia's North, details the massacres from 1824 until the 1980s and adds to that work by revealing not only the perpetrators of massacres, but also their enablers, both public and private. Dr. Smith says her work shows police were not the principal perpetrators and other settlers were involved in the killings. Opposition leader Peter Dutton has revealed the proposed sites for 7 nuclear reactors. The coalition plans to build reactors at Tarong and Kallide in Queensland, Liddell and Mount Piper in New South Wales, Port Augusta in South Australia, Loy Yang in Victoria and Maja in Western Australia. The coalition plans to have the first nuclear reactor ready by 2035, despite a report by the CSIRO saying nuclear power plants couldn't be built until 2024 at the earliest. Mr. Dutton argues nuclear is the way forward for Australia.
We know that the government has a renewables-only policy which is just not fit for purpose. No other country in the world can keep the lights on 24/7 with the renewables-only policy. We need to make sure that hospitals can stay on 24/7. We need to make sure that cold rooms can stay on 24/7. We need to make sure that our economy can function 24/7, and we can only do that with a strong baseload power.
A trip by senior members of the Australian government, including Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles, Foreign Minister Penny Wong and other senior officials, is heading to PNG as Chinese Premier Li Qiang ends his 4-day trip in Australia. Premier Li and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese ended the first trip by a Chinese premier in 7 years by praising a new chapter in the relationship between Australia and China, but the visit was not without controversy. The Prime Minister and Chinese Premier's meeting with business leaders in Western Australia was partly overshadowed by an incident last Monday in which Chinese embassy officials attempted to block news cameras from filming Australian journalist Chang Lai. Mr. Albanese told the ABC in Perth his government had followed up with the Chinese embassy to express concern, describing the attempt to block the Australian journalist who was detained in China between 2020 and 2023 as pretty clumsy. Opposition leader Peter Dutton, who also met with Premier Li during his visit, said he had also raised the issue.
We raised the issue of Chang Lai, which was a very regrettable incident, and I'm very pleased to hear that the government's raised that with the Chinese embassy, because it's completely unacceptable in our free society for that sort of conduct to take place.
Victoria will become the first Australian state to raise the minimum age of criminal responsibility to 12. Premier Jacinta Ardern and Youth Justice Minister Enver Erdogan introduced the long-awaited Youth Justice Bill, which would lift the age from 10 to state parliament yesterday. Ms. Ardern told reporters children under 12 should not be treated as criminals.
This is legislation that will reduce youth offending, it will increase community safety, but also, too importantly, it will provide an opportunity for young people to turn their lives around, because 10 and 11-year-olds don't belong in the criminal justice system. Simply, they belong in schools and in places where they're getting support.
Currently, children as young as 10 can be charged, convicted and imprisoned in every Australian state and territory except the Northern Territory. The NT raised the age of criminal responsibility to 12 in August, while the ACT passed legislation to raise the age to 14 by 2025, with some exceptions. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claims US Secretary of State Anthony Albanese Anthony Blinken, has assured him that the U.S. government is working to cancel restrictions on arms deliveries to Israel. But Anthony Blinken has denied the claims that Washington is withholding weapons needed for the war in Gaza and has instead clarified that a single shipment of 907-kilogram bombs remains under review, but that all the other arms deliveries are moving forward. And Lebanon's Health Minister Firas Abiad said he is concerned over escalating tensions on the Israel-Lebanon border after Israel approved attack plans against southern Lebanon. The Israeli Defense Forces has announced that it has approved attack plans and taken steps to accelerate field readiness. Currently visiting Australia, Mr. Abiad tells SBS Arabic 24, Lebanon's health sector is prepared for all eventualities.
In fact, we are concerned about an expansion in these confrontations. Therefore, since the beginning of the war, there has been preparedness in the health sector in several areas, including providing a quantity of medicines and supplies that we may need in the event that matters develop and there is a breakdown in the communication.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has arrived in North Korea as he seeks partners to boost Russia's war against Ukraine. Mr. Putin has pledged his unwavering support in a letter published by North Korean state media promising to build trade and security systems. He says the two countries have developed good relations and partnerships over the past 70 years and would develop agreements not controlled by the West and resist what he described as illegitimate unilateral restrictions in the form of Western sanctions. The visit comes amid heightened tensions on the South Korean border after North Korean soldiers crossed the military demarcation line on Tuesday. This South Korean resident said he did not consider North Korea's military activities or the Russian president's visit to Pyongyang to be a security threat.
It seems North Korea is carrying out provocations, like what they've done before. As a resident of the borderline area, it doesn't make me feel psychologically daunted. Neither do I think war would break out right away tomorrow.
And to sport, Queensland centre Hamiso Tabuai-Fido, known as Hammer, is poised to become the leading try scorer in state of origin history. At 22, he's scoring 1.6 tries per match and has 8 tries in 5 games for the Maroons, ranking 16th on the all-time list. No other player with more than one origin match has a better strike rate. He's just one try behind former Maroons captain Darren Lockyer, who scored 9 tries in 36 games. The current leading try scorer is Greg Inglis with 18 tries in 32 games. For New South Wales, Brad Fittler, Jared Hayne and Josh Adoka lead with 11 tries each. And now having a look at the weather around the country, Broome, sunny 30, Perth, mostly sunny 19, Adelaide, showers increasing 18, Melbourne, mostly sunny 13, Hobart, shower or 2, 11, Albury-Wodonga, mostly sunny 10, Canberra, partly cloudy 10 as well, Wollongong, sunny 16, Sydney, also sunny 16, Newcastle, much the same, 17, Brisbane, similar conditions, 22, Townsville, sunny 24, Cairns, mostly sunny 26, Alice Springs, partly cloudy 26, Darwin, sunny 31, and at West Strait Islands, a partly cloudy day and a top of 28 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this afternoon. Coming up next, conversation with Biranga Wiradjuri, founder and principal artist of the Biranga Gallery in Meanjin, sharing insights into an upcoming tourism initiative that's set to offer a unique experience steeped in Indigenous history and culture. And after 13 years of dedicated campaigning in the Awabakal community in the Hunter region of New South Wales, the community is celebrating the protection of its sacred butterfly cave. But first, experts are urging caution due to a high number of scammers proliferating online as tax season is fast approaching. New data from the Commonwealth Bank of Australia suggests 24% of Australians have already been targeted with a tax-related scam. And as SBS's Sam Dover reports, one in three Australians struggle to identify different types of scams.
With tax season fast approaching, experts are urging caution due to a high number of scammers who are using the opportunity to target Australians for their personal and financial information. New data from the Commonwealth Bank of Australia suggests that 24% of Australians have already been targeted with a tax-related scam. The Commonwealth Bank's General Manager of Group Fraud Management Services, James Roberts, says their research also shows that many people don't understand how to best identify these scams.
CBA's latest research found that one in four people have been exposed to a tax-related scam. So while many Aussies are eagerly awaiting their tax return, unfortunately, scammers will also be hoping to capitalise on the moment. That's why we've tested people on their ability to spot scams, and encouragingly, 69% successfully identified all of the scams. But that also means that roughly one in three didn't.
So, if so many have already been exposed to these scams, and with many more to come over the tax season, how can we better understand what to look for and how these kinds of scams work? Samantha York works for the Australian Communications and Media Authority, the government's national communications regulator. She says scammers have become very sophisticated and new technology has allowed them to evade targeted anti-scam efforts.
Scammers are increasingly pretty sophisticated criminal networks these days, proving to be very agile in adapting their methods when we start to crack down on a certain type of scam or a certain distribution platform. They take advantage of our being very focused on tax at the moment to contact us because they know that that would be expected from us at this time of year and that we would therefore be more trusting.
The regulator has addressed an increase in scam numbers by introducing new regulatory codes that ensure telecommunication companies are increasing their efforts to detect and block scammers before they have the chance to reach their victims. If they fail to comply to these codes, they can be fined up to $250,000. Ms. York says scammers have a number of approach methods but will often seek to mimic correspondence from government bodies like MyGov and the Australian Taxation Office.
What we have seen are often robocalls or calls from people who are pretending to be from the tax office, calling on the basis of an urgent debt that needs to be paid or to request personal information from you in order to process a tax refund. Contact can also be made by email or by SMS that often include links to follow to update or fix your personal information to receive a fake refund.
This method of impersonating reputable sources to lure victims into providing personal information is a well-known scam practice known as phishing. According to the National Anti-Scam Centre's January to March 2024 quarterly report, phishing was the top reported scam type in Australia, followed by false billing scams and identity theft. So, how can you spot the difference between a phishing scam and official correspondence from the ATO regarding your taxes? Assistant Commissioner with the ATO, Rob Thompson, says there are a few warning signs to watch for that likely indicate you've been contacted by a scammer.
We will never send an unsolicited email or SMS that contains a QR code or a hyperlink to log into our online services or to MyGov. The second is we're never going to ask for your passwords, your account numbers or any other personal data via email, SMS or unsolicited phone calls. The other one is the ATO numbers actually come up as no caller ID, so they don't show a number. And the fourth one is we will never threaten people with immediate arrest or demand that they stay on the phone until they've made a payment.
The National Anti-Scam Centre's latest targeting scams report revealed Australians lost $2.74 billion to scams in 2023 over a reported 601,000 different scams. While this was a 13.1% decline in losses when compared to 2022, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, or ACCC, which runs the Anti-Scam Centre, says this decline wasn't seen in the over 65 age demographic. They continue to lose the most to scammers each year. Katrina Lowe, acting chair of the ACCC, says this may be due to a number of reasons.
Retirees may not. Not all, of course, but many retirees may have more substantial savings. They may be more actively, therefore, looking for savings and investments opportunities. And people over 65s are not what we would call digital natives. So in some respects, they may be less familiar with the tricks and traps that scammers use in order to lure their victims in.
However, Ms. Lowe says anyone can fall victim to a scam regardless of age due to the psychology used by scammers to cloud a victim's judgment.
Scammers we do see are increasingly sophisticated in getting consumers into what's called a hot state, so a high emotional state, whether that be urgency or fear or excitement. It's where our usual cautions may be overridden.
She says the best advice for consumers is to remember three words when navigating a potential scam situation: stop, think, and protect.
So stop. Before you click on that link or make that transfer, think, do I really know who I'm dealing with? Independently find the phone number, independently find the website and check that what sounds like a good opportunity is in fact legitimate, and protect. Trust your instincts. If something doesn't feel right, report the matter to your financial institution and to ScamWatch.
When someone finds they've become a victim of a scammer, it can cause feelings of confusion and shame. But Ms. Lowe says you mustn't blame yourself for the actions of an increasingly sophisticated criminal network.
We know that people do often feel a sense of shame or embarrassment about being caught, but the important thing to remember is firstly, you are not alone. People from all walks of life, all ages, all demographics have been caught by scammers. And secondly, you have been targeted by a financial criminal. It is a deliberate, sophisticated trap. Like any crime, it is not the fault of the victim, it is the fault of the criminal.
Samantha York from the Australian Communications and Media Authority says the more conversations had about scams with loved ones, the more they'll feel empowered to speak up if they have concerns or if they feel like they may be a victim.
It's really important to talk about scams with your family and friends and your colleagues, because people are naturally quite embarrassed or ashamed if they've been targeted by a scam, and particularly if they've been foiled by a scam. So the more that we talk about scams as a society, we kind of destigmatize them.
Sam Dover, SBS News.
We must now go to a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about a new Indigenous tourism experience in Meanjin, Brisbane, steeped in Indigenous history and culture. Stay tuned.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
The Indigenous Story Bridge Adventure Climb provides a unique opportunity to explore Brisbane's iconic story bridge while at the same time learning about the city's Indigenous heritage. The unique experience is the result of a partnership between the Birunga Gallery and Howard Smith Wharves. Now, I'm happy to say I'm joined by Birunga Wiradjuri, founder and principal artist of the Birunga Gallery. Birunga, first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us about this unique Indigenous tourism experience and how it will change the way visitors get to know Brisbane from a unique perspective or even a vantage point?
Thank you. I just got to start off. I'm Eastern Plains Wiradjuri, and we're operating here in Meanjin with permission and through ceremony with the TOs, and we've got some really beautiful relationships over a very long period of time. So we recognise that we have no cultural authority here. We always engage respectfully and continue to engage respectfully in those relationships and really ensure those relationships laden with reciprocity and respect. So that's kind of the get-go, because having permission culturally and sanctioned culturally to live, prosper and do business here means that we're able to make opportunities available for the education of the dominant paradigm and, you know, for people coming in from overseas, because, I mean, that's kind of the thing. The people that are from here, the Gabbars, aren't always the most receptive to these truths, whereas overseas people really are. It's quite an interesting dynamic. So we get an opportunity to, and again, have checked in about what stories we tell here, my family law storytelling. So it's a bit of a natural for me. But we went up, we got a great relationship. Luke Fraser's the CEO of Howard Smith Wharf, and he and I have developed a friendship over the last little while, like probably 2 or 3 years now. And you know how these things go, one thing leads to another. And when we found out that Howard Smith Wharf's purchased this Adventure Quine, I started just to think about, well, you've got this unique opportunity, this unique position on the top of this bridge, where you're kind of surrounded 360 degree by air and country. And when I first went up and did the climb, I was actually pretty dragging my feet a little bit, because heights don't worry me, and I'm pretty pressed for time. But I went up, and when I got up there, I realised a couple of things. And one of the things was, in particular, that the stories of the climb that have been when we're not doing them, really about how many rivets are in the bridge, about, you know, that it constitutes the shortest highway in Australia, you know, and some other bits and bobs around. And when we're up there, and there's other blackfellas, the team from our crew came up as well, and I was just sort of, I found myself sort of saying, I was looking to the horizon and finding where the bunyas were and where the hoop pines were, and you could see up to the Glasshouse Mountains, I think it was Mount Biwa up there, you could see, and over Mulgulpin and Minjerribar, and then off back down into the west. I started sort of thinking, oh, well, maybe our role is to contribute to, you know, some sort of counter perspectives. One in particular was that when you're standing on the Story Bridge, you're actually standing on the eastern perimeter of the exclusion zone around the story of Boundary Street. So when you're on that Story Bridge, you're above Main Street. That runs down to Vulture Street, which runs across sort of west to Boundary Street in West End, where the flag, the Koori flag is on the intersection there, right down Boundary across the river to the northern Boundary Street and then back along. And you've got the opportunity to let people know, you know, look at this real estate. This was the real estate when the colonials set up camp here, where they, local blackfellas, were excluded from dusk until well after dawn. And if you're in that space, you know, the consequences were dire. People that grew up here don't know that story a lot of the time. And those Boundary Street stories are right across, well, they're across the continent, you know. But in Queensland, the way I understand it is pretty much every street that's called Boundary Street demarcation zone. And then that opens up other opportunities, because it knocks them on their tail. It really does. We just did it the other day. We went up for a photo shoot with Tourism Australia, and they had a group of, talent that looked great on camera and all that sort of thing up. But we had to go through the stories anyway. They were getting cranky because we had to stop going, you know, halfway through the story, because we had to do different poses or the sun was in the wrong spot or whatever. But, even in just that context, it was very well received. So it's exciting.
It's really interesting you said that the locals don't know about it, and you get more interest from overseas visitors. Why is that?
You know, look, I'm guessing, because you can't be in people's shoes, you know, but I think both, you know, the colonial presence here and the overseas people both have this preconceived notion about who we are, who mob is, you know. But the people from the people that are here already have this, you know, I think, you know, if they hear a counter perspective, it may be welcome, but it's probably a bit challenging. And it's certainly inconvenient to their, you know, continuing internal narrative about how things are when they start to, because I don't know, you know, not many of them have less than 2 or 3 degrees of separation between mob and themselves, you know. Whereas the overseas mob, they tend to think that all the blackfellas are at Uluru or whatever, and they're really open to finding out more, whereas the local mobs, the local gubbars, they've got a conviction about how things are in their mind, and I think it's just a little bit more challenging for them to come into the realities of their entitlement than that privilege. That gets challenged quite quickly, whereas the fellows from across the way don't necessarily have that to deal with. And we work with it. I mean, that's a cultural responsibility where if we're standing up and telling yarns that are truth-laden, then, you know, there is an education aspect to that. My experience is, for the better part, if people are signing up for something that where there is truth-telling as a part of it, they are interested. It's very rare that you get severe pushback, but, you know, we were up there the other day and a fella started telling me how it was. But it wasn't that he was being ignorant or arrogant. He was just trying to contribute. And the body of information that he was working from to contribute was pretty severely flawed, you know. So then that was an opportunity for me to gently sort of engage with that and talk about things from our perspective rather than from the colonial narrative. And that meant that everybody that was there, and there was fellas from Asian descent, fellas there and that sort of stuff. And so you just use the opportunity, you know.
Yeah, and yourself, you're a cultural practitioner and a visual artist, but the climbs are led by indigenous guides from different backgrounds telling their stories. What can you tell us about the stories they tell?
What the deal is the way this came around, I've developed a couple of experiences for tourists around the importance of place. And those products have been, you know, really well received. When Luke and I started talking about what to do with this, I realised, like, so those products, I began developing them in, like, 2016. And, you know, it takes time. But I've got chops there now, I guess, and there's a bit of crossover that I can do. So I just said to Luke, look, I'll invest some time in being, you know, so I'm training up and the other guides, participants or graduates from our cultural creative development program, which we run for young or youngish emerging First Nations artists. We kind of include these things as a part of the curriculum. So then you've got not just storytelling, but you get public speaking. You've got a whole lot of different skills that come out of that. So in the initial instance, I guess you'd say heading it up. Well, certainly to keep a gauge on what stories are being told, because they need to be contemporary. You know, they need to not then, you know, you can't be talking for the local, the Yuggera Turrbal or Jagera mob around anything like that. So it needs to be kind of in the public domain. Just because it's in the public domain, that doesn't mean that fellas really know about it. And then you've got a very short period of time, because the climb goes for about 2 hours. You know, you are up there for a fair while. It's certainly, you don't just get up and come back down, but it's a short period of time and the information that's available. I mean, you're standing there looking at, you know, there's a particular school there that gets, you know, celebrated. But the story that we've got there is, you know, they talk about it being an amazing thing for putting young women through and all that sort of jazz. But what they don't talk about is, you know, they had First Nations girls from here in servitude there, unpaid. One of those then girls was only dawn daylight up here, you know. So we can tell those sorts of stories. And I guess it, my commitment then is to have the young ones, like, say, young Kane Brunji, Taisha Martin King. So Kane's Gunguri Kabi Kabi lad, Taisha's Bunjalung from down by Yugal, and then there's Jess Skeen, who's a Gukul Taipan girl, and they're artists in their own right. We'll work together to develop the framework that will sort of inform how that grows and develops. And then I guess, you know, let's see what happens from there. But investing in a significant time in developing it so that it's a stable and organic, if that makes sense, you know what I mean? Like, it's got to have everyone's flavor, you know, each individual or each mob's flavor too, really, into it about how they tell their stories. But basically, we make sure that we're solid in what we do say and what we don't say, how we say it, and about letting people really know, again, that thing about having no cultural authority here. We need to make sure that we're responsible with that.
And it's said that the climbs are not just about storytelling. There is also sampling indigenous foods and including you know, native herbs and spices, and there's also the throwing of boomerangs and painting workshops. It's really a lot of things to experience during a short period of time. What can you tell us about these other experiences?
I mean, we've been up there a few times now, four, five, six times. I remember going up with Jess and T. And so what happens, you're on the south side of the river to Kangaroo Point, and you go up the eastern side of the bridge, you go up to the peak, you have a bit of a Doris, tell the stories and, you know, whatever. Then you go down that side to about halfway, and you walk across over the roadway, and then you reverse it, right, and you come back. And when we were coming back on the city side, Jess and I had a moment that, I don't know, something else was going on. We just sort of, and she said to me and T, she's looked over, she's gone, that park down there. And we're looking down. And she said, I can still remember. So when she was a little girl, her dad, Uncle Joe Skeen, used to teach Japanese tourists how to throw the boomerangs down there, right? They'd be a bit iffy about it, about doing it, because they didn't want to lose face, or, you know, like, they didn't want to get it wrong. So Uncle Joe would get Jess, who's the youngest daughter or the youngest of the kids, to come through, and it was almost like, oh, well, if she can do it, you can do it thing. So she'd come in and throw the boomerang. And so we're standing up, you know, soft, and she's telling me stories about about all this sort of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And then we have our own catering. We offer, I think they call it a native tasting platter. So you got roux, croc, emu, and then everything, like, you know, finger lime and all that sort of jazz through it. They're pretty, I had one, I was sort of, had a bit of a graze on one there, so they continue to be very good. But then Jess is going to do a boomerang painting workshop down the bottom, which will be an addition, you know, after the climb. I took my time to come around to it, because I'm not really a fan of that kind of, well, you're nearly a ticker box kind of thing, you know, like, oh, let's paint a boomerang and get to know the blackfellas or whatever. And not to be dismissive, I mean, these things, if they're purposeful and there's a point to it, I'm all for it. If it's just ticking a box, I'm not. And I talked to Jess about it, and what ends up being the thread through that interaction is they get a different perspective, because they've just been up the bridge, say, with me, and they've got some different stories. They come back down, and then they're going to be hearing about, I don't even call it, they call it fake art, but it's not even art, like, you know, that cultural appropriation type stuff.
Yeah.
So she uses that workshop then to, because Uncle Joe has developed this amazing entrepreneurial business over decades, where the Skeens produce, among other things, you know, boomerangs and other artifacts for sale for tourism. It's made by Mob.
And that was Biranga Wiradjuri, founder and principal artist of the multi-award winning Biranga Gallery, situated in the heart of Mianjin, Brisbane, talking about a new Indigenous-themed tourism experience. Now, this is only part of our conversation. The full interview is published on our website. Coming up after the break, the Awabako community in New South Wales is celebrating the protection of a sacred cave.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Welcome back. Now, after 13 years of dedicated campaigning, the Awabakal community in New South Wales Hunter region is celebrating the protection of its sacred butterfly cave. The state government has purchased the land to create a national park preserving this historically significant Aboriginal women's site in West Wall's End. Samuel Harib reports.
The Awabakal community in the New South Wales Hunter region is celebrating the protection of its sacred butterfly cave. After 13 years of campaigning, the state government has purchased the land to create a national park. Located in West Wallsend, this significant Aboriginal site has a history spanning tens of thousands of years and was the first sacred women's site recognized in New South Wales. Among those fighting to save the cave was Auntie Lynn Brown, an Aboriginal role model in the Awabakal community. She says the cave holds cultural importance for the Awabakal people, who used it for birthing, spiritual ceremonies, and teaching young girls about women's business.
The whole area is significant. That's where they all used to gather. So, and to destroy that would break many many histories, many wounds within the community. That's a place where we all used to, you know, catch up and be a part of, you know, Aboriginal history. So the history has always been there, but to hear that there was going to be development there, it was going to break our hearts, and we didn't want anything to happen to us.
Auntie Lynn says hearing the site had been saved was an incredible feeling. Until recently, Albacol women had to ask permission to walk on the track to the cave, but now they can go to the sacred site whenever they want.
The announcement of saving the cave, saving the site around it, was amazing. It was like someone just, our hearts were broken and they just mended it. So it was just a great feeling, excitement, crying, happiness. And we done it. We finally done it. It took us a long time. We continued to fight and fight and fight till we, you know, got what we needed for our community and our Aboriginal people.
She believes this victory will empower others to fight for the protection of their sacred sites.
In the past, they've always stopped everybody and everybody gave up. You know, they said, no, that's not going to happen. But, you know, hopefully people say, we're never ever going to give up. We're going to keep fighting and fighting for our rights.
New South Wales Minister for Heritage and the Environment, Penny Sharp, has been working to free the site from developers. She says the victory was hard won.
This is a tribute to the tenacity of the women who've, you know, built a campaign for over 10 years and refused to take no for an answer. But I also want to acknowledge that the developers come to the party and been willing to, you know, allow the government to purchase the land and to hand it over to the National Parks and Wildlife Service.
She says the fact that the state was able to acquire the site from the developers is significant.
It's really important. I mean, this has been recognised as a significant Aboriginal place since 2013. But what's really important is that it understood the context of the area, the importance of the journey to get there, and ensuring that the cave is actually well-maintained in things like water flow and those kind of things. It's sort of the intangible part of the whole story that makes it so special. And it's really important that we've been able to make sure that the health of the cave is as important as the journey, as important as this piece of bushland as well.
Clayton Barr, the New South Wales Member of Parliament for the electorate of Cessnock, has also been actively involved in advocating for the protection of the Butterfly Cave. He describes the site's importance to the Albacol people and why it was important for him to bring justice to the Albacol women.
But the significance and importance of connectivity to culture and connection to country, and how important this site was to that, and that they were still actively, very, very actively using that site with the younger women coming through and connecting them with their culture and doing what they call sister speak. And the significance historically over 60,000 years to this site. So, you know, it was pretty obvious right from the start that there was a justice question here. And my role as the MP, albeit I'm male, but my role was to assist these women to realise justice. And that's been the pathway and journey which has kept us connected over these last 13 years. And it's been a real privilege of mine, a real honour.
Mr. Barr remembers the moment the women heard that a deal had been reached and that the government was buying the site from the developer.
And we got the women together and told them there, and obviously it was stunned disbelief at first, and then you could see it gradually sinking in to the faces and the women, and then of course it was tears and joy and hugs and tears and joy and hugs and tears and joy and hugs. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And and again, it's just overwhelming. I can't describe, and I'm a white male, but I can't describe how significant it was to finally realise justice after such a long and drawn-out battle where there was a lot of goodwill at all levels of government, across all political sides of government, but we just weren't quite delivering what was needed until just now.
Aslam Al-Ghalib, SBS News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
And that was absolutely everybody by Mitch Tambo in Gamilaroi language. And that's all we have time for on NITV Radio this Wednesday afternoon. Thank you very much for your company today. Bertrand Tungandami wishing you an excellent afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.